Hey, Jimmy.
Hey, Angela.
This is
Books
Are
Good.
Good. Actually.
Actually.
That is our new Echo introduction that we're doing. Not really.
No.
No, we're not totally not doing it. So before we get into today's book, I want to announce that I finished my NaNoWriMo yesterday. So I think there's a day left. I think it literally ends tomorrow. I hope people who are working on it are able to complete whatever their goal was, even if it wasn't 50k words. Mm-hmm. Someone on a forum that I joined managed to complete it in like 7 days, 50k words. She's like,
wow.
Yeah, she like someone joked like, oh yeah, the so and so is gonna complete in like 3 days, and they're off by off by four. Yeah.
7,000 words on average a day?
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah.
Okay. Sure. Why not?
Like, exactly.
Live your life.
Exactly.
However you're going to live it.
Anyway, so the book we're reading for the month of November
is Angela's new book.
Oh, no, we're not. That is going straight into the sun. So we read Blood, Sweat, and Pixels by Jason Schreier, and let's start off the usual. Jimmy, what was your impression of the book?
Good. It's, it does not necessarily delve into what I thought it could. It is more, it does a good job for what it is trying to do, which is like give you an idea of how different games are made by different companies and the struggles that they encounter. I could definitely see it being more, but for what it is, it does a good job, and it's a fun read.
Yeah, it's definitely a fun read. As someone who's, I've done game jams, which are, there are different time limits for them, but you essentially make a game in like a month, or sometimes typically 48 hours. You can do it with people or by yourself, and I usually do them by myself. And if you ever done those types of things, it's really, really hard, and you have to like slice off so many things to complete a game. And so I wasn't unfamiliar with video game making and the process of it, but especially the chapter with Stardew Valley, I didn't realize it was just a single person and that who wrote constant like code for 5 fucking years.
Yeah.
Which, yeah, that makes sense.
Code, yeah. And do code, art and art, music, yes. And yeah.
Yeah. So I wasn't unfamiliar with it, and I do agree that at the same, yes, I wish he would have gone a little bit more into maybe why it's, or I guess he does, but I think from a, he goes more into like, you know, why it's difficult, but I think sometimes some things are left unsaid. I guess we can explain that a bit later.
Mm-hmm.
But I think for like, if a parent who doesn't really know video games or people who don't really know how they're made, this is a pretty good book. It describes different terminology, like what's a game engine, like, and why does that matter about the game engine? Like why that's really important that people decide on the game engine really early on instead of halfway through fucking production and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's definitely a lot of this is really good as like an intro to like both why games are and why games aren't, and giving you an idea of like just how precarious a balancing act making a game is. And it's a really quick read. I'm always a little, I really shouldn't be, especially with this month coming up, but I'm always a little lazy about like starting old books. So like, I'll be like, okay, I'm a third of the month in, let me like crack this book and like start reading. And normally I'll get it like a feel for like, oh, I have to crunch on this book, or I can like do this in like however many days worth of reading for however many hours per day. But this, like, I read this in like 2 days.
Yeah, I was tempted to read it in 2 days because I like opened it and I was like, oh, each chapter, because like on the Kindle says, you know, how many minutes left per chapter. And I was like, oh, these are 20-minute chapters. Like I can speed read these. And also, are you, I guess we kind of dovetail into this. Are you familiar with Jason Schreier's writings? He writes game articles for, formerly for Kotaku, but now he's with,
Gizmodo?
No, he's for Bloomberg Technology.
Okay. No, not really.
Okay, so his beat is covering a lot of the industries, the industry in general. So the last couple of months have been about crunch, especially with CD Projekt Red.
Sure.
He's definitely had stories about why, kind of like the movement of certain like individuals leaving companies and kind of that. He definitely was on the ground floor for the Ubisoft. Like I think his big story is the Ubisoft sexual misconduct. That happened this year, which led to a lot of people leaving and also a lot of the inner workings of Ubisoft being kind of revealed for people. There's a lot of nepotism and other shit just being shuffled around. So he's a really big...
I wonder what structural causes there are for that.
Yeah, it's we'll never know. So he's, you know, he's one of those... people who are embedded in the industry. He's not just a game reviewer, and I'm not trying to ride like game reviewers if that's just the thing you do, but he does the industry in general, which is really insightful. However, if you ever look at his Twitter and he does a leak or something, people are like, oh, you're a, if it's like a leak for a Microsoft thing, like, wow, you're a Sony fanboy. And he's like, look, I'm just reporting the leaks. I had, this is not like,
this not is not personal. My personal Twitter.
Yeah.
Okay. Good to know. That makes this book make a lot more sense. This is not someone who's like, I really like these games, like, or like, I was really hoping to see Star Wars 1313 after seeing that E3 demo. Like, what happened to it? No, this is someone who lives in this world of like production companies and development companies and. Okay, so yeah, this all makes more sense.
Yeah, and you know, if you notice as reading through it, he touches on it a couple of times, but like he talks about crunch and like in the epilogue, he's like, oh yeah, so you know, you did all that, like you're over budget, you've like crunched for like 6 months and all this other stuff, and that's his main beat for sure.
Can we jump questions? Because I feel like we've said the word a few times now.
Yes.
What is crunch?
So crunch is essentially a time period over months or even years for some people, it depends, in which you're working over 40-hour weeks to get deadlines. This is like maybe 80 to 100-hour weeks at times. And one big article that came out about crunch initially, this was about 15 years ago, was at EA. There was an EA wife letter that came out, and it was pretty much like, my spouse works at EA, they sleep at the office, they've missed anniversaries, they've missed other life achievements to work on, you know, Sims Madden Football Edition, whatever, for the EA game. So essentially, you know, crunch is a mandatory, and they say it's not mandatory, but it's mandatory. Overtime, unpaid overtime.
Because your salary, most likely.
Yes, you're salaried. Are you for U.S. laws? That means that you just don't get paid. They mention in here that for Polish laws, they actually get paid for overtime. But, you know, companies can lie or kind of say, oh, you're a contractor or you're hourly. Actually, they probably won't even try to make you hourly. You might say, like, you're part-time or contractor, some shit like that to potentially not pay you money.
Yeah, change your work code for those other hours so that, say, like, you're working a slightly different position. So this is it's like you're two different employees.
Yeah, another company that is notorious for this was Rockstar. Well, I say was, but who knows? They say they're changing how they work. But it's been known that people would need to come in on the weekends because the president would come by, the president of their company, excuse me. And generally what people would do is that they were like, no, you just need to look like you're working. They weren't working, but they need to look like they're working. So when they tour the office, it's like, okay, cool. I'm glad everyone comes in. Granted, you know, they do all the usual excuses. Well, everyone's putting in 100 hours. You know, the upper management, they're also, you know, coming in and doing all these fucking meetings and shit like that.
Except, which is, you know, meetings over sushi. Is that really the same as like spending like 10 hours this week hunting down bugs?
Yeah, it's not. No. So that's what crunch is. The problem gets exacerbated because there's a deadline for your publisher. You said, hey, I'm going to release this game November 22nd. Mm-hmm. And then it turns out, oh no, we need to fix a bunch of bugs or game-breaking bugs or whatever.
Story's been changed.
Actually, by then, story, that doesn't really... I think most crunching comes down to bug fixing.
Mm-hmm.
And because the scope of the games are so large that
it becomes difficult.
Yeah. Mainly comes down to bug fixing. It's really not story or other stuff, like, you know, story or narrative wise. It's really just, okay, does this game perform well on these do these games perform well on the systems that we said we support? Yada yada yada.
So at least as far as this book goes, story can definitely derail things, but yes, only in the case of games that then failed to launch.
Yeah, for the most part. I think Uncharted 3, it seemed like they changed the story quite a bit in pre-production.
Do you mean 4?
Oh shit, Uncharted 4, yes.
Yeah. Yes. But that was also due to the change in developer. Not developer. Yeah,
but the director.
Yeah,
the
director. Director. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, so as I was saying before, our silent partner Craig left us, there's an expectation of like in these contracts of like, okay, if you get like 85 or 90 on these meta review boards, you're going to get a couple $1 million payout, which could be used for like bonuses, or could be used as like a war chest for like developing their own games, what have you, so they're less dependent on production companies. And there is also the incentive of the production company and the development company in combination of like, well, if we put out a subpar game by working less hours, then we're probably not going to sell as many of the game, and either we're not going to get picked up by this production company to make another game, so we need to do as much as we possibly can to get this put out in a state where it's going to reward us in the immediate from our contract and going to allow us to continue to develop games with this production company or be seen as a studio that makes quality games, which you definitely want to be, but I'll save the rest of this ramble for our last question. Anyway.
Yeah. You kind of want to be the studio that puts out quality work. However, mm-hmm. I don't think it's not said in this book, but, the studios that he kind of interviewed are definitely ones that are kind of control their own destinies. There's definitely mm-hmm. studios under, say, like publisher EA that puts out like Barbie adventure game or mm-hmm. different IP, like movie-based IP games that you see out. Like they just mm-hmm. kind of contract out those studios to do that type of work. So
and that was where the developers for Shovel Knight came from. They were a part of a studio that just made like mobile scrollers based off of like movie studio IP.
Yeah. So there's, I want to say, I guess there would just be different tiers of studios you could potentially work for. And I can understand, especially from the Shovel Knight, you know, that they express, well, it kind of sucks being not control your destiny of like being creative, right? Because you're just kind of building these shovelware, type of games to mm-hmm. just get out as quickly, you know, you make them really cheap, you get them, you know, farted out as quickly as possible, okay, and then you're, you know, you work on the next contract.
Mm-hmm.
That's how a lot of these other studios work, especially for other third-party type of games. Like Capcom for a while would just outsource all of their PC games to get transitioned over from console games, which kind of leads to this really weird relationship between Capcom and those other studios. Especially, you know, Capcom's a Japanese company. Some of these studios are English companies. So there's always a language barrier. If you ever want to go deep dive into like why certain video games came out and were just garbage, Mac McMuscles is a YouTuber. He does a What Happened videos that are usually voted on by the community or his Patreon subscribers. And a lot of them are fucking Capcom games. But Capcom has been around for like 30 fucking years. So like you're going to come out with some doozies eventually.
Yeah.
So a lot of the times, the reason why a game comes out from like, oh, a, you know, top, like a AAA publisher or whatever, is because generally they outsource it and mismanage it and kind of just don't check in. They change a bunch of shit, which is described in the same way as Star Wars 1313.
Yeah.
Just shit like that. So like this is honestly scratching the surface of just general fuckery with the game industry. Mm-hmm. Like it is so like the amount, like you don't hear about this with like other software development. Like you get an oopsie whoopsie and that'll be the big headline story. But like most software development companies, and I'm in one, so this is why I'm saying this, they try to just keep all their shit out of the headlines. They only care about, you know, their customers and their SLAs and then doing right by them and then not have a huge fucking data breach or do something really fucking stupid or try not to have their shit hacked and then that's a big headline. Game studios just work completely fucking different from most, from generally all software development, development. There's the same principles, but there's just an added layer of extra shit, which Schreier describes. And I guess we're kind of going to another question of, you know, what's different from game development to software development? Well, the first thing is, if I'm engineer one, I get assigned make a widget. I just need to make a widget that changes my website from blue to green, and then I'm done. I'm not asked subjective stuff like, well, does this make the customer happy?
Does this widget change feel good? Like, so when you as the end user are like going to put in your credit card information, do these fields like pop up at the appropriate time as far as like your speed run of entering your shipping and payment information feel good?
Yeah. So it's just like there's definitely a UX UI portion of software development that's like a separate piece that there's more studies of like how do you organize, you know, your site and does it meet certain needs for what is needed. But like game development comes down to, well, we have to be partially done with this project before we're like, well, is this fun? And do these certain mechanics work? Do they work properly? Do all five of our mechanics that we say, do they work well together? And that can be very difficult to do from the jump. Like, you can have the greatest fucking idea ever, but if it's not fun, then you failed.
And that can vary depending on like genre to genre. Like an MMORPG is going to be probably incredibly like late in the game where you finally like get the feel like, okay, is everything flowing together? Are these quests all working? Like, does combat feel good in between people who just like find each other in the world versus say like an RTS, you could probably without like the art and whatnot, just create like a bunch of like different like colored squares that have like the combat attributes that you want them to have and like just have like a gray box where you test out battles. Like that could probably occur much sooner than say like an adventure RPG where you're like interacting with the 3D world.
Yeah, and they kind of described this with The Witcher 3 where they had to like do I thought the way that they did the quest, creating quests was actually really cool, where they just have a group that's just dedicated to making the quest and following it through the entire time. And then like reiterating through it to make it great. However, the problem was that none of the animations were in, none of the models were in. They had to try to, like, I guess probably none of the voice acting was in either. So they probably, you know, they had people like mime Geralt and, you know, whomever he's interacting with and be like, okay, but do you see this thing, you know, like how this would work out? And that must have like been so nerve-wracking to like, you know, do all this work and then be like, I don't really fucking see it. And it's like, okay, well, you have these three Geralt models and they're just like, you know, probably rigged a certain way to like, yeah. And then he goes, yeah, and kills the guy or whatever. And they also mentioned like in the QA that they just put God mode on Geralt. So he was just, they had no clue the pacing of some of the
yeah. It's like, okay, so I'm going to take two swings and kill this guy, but we'll make it more difficult later down the line. So what was surprising about the process of making a video game?
I guess one thing that was surprising to me was I highlighted this about the Uncharted 4 thing, and it was their management style. Generally, I think, oh, okay, once you want to make a video game product, you kind of have an overarching, you know, mission or, you know, goal or whatever. And then you kind of go through it and you iterate like maybe certain pieces of it. But I thought it was interesting that how they worked was everyone's supposed to, at Naughty Dog, supposed to manage themselves. But so a programmer who had an idea for a feature, I'm reading from there, sorry. Quote, in another studio, a programmer who had an idea for a feature might be expected to book a request with the producer before talking to his colleagues. At Naughty Dog, the programmer could just get up, walk across the room, and tell the designer what he thought. And that might, to me, that might sound good. You're like, oh, yeah, you, a programmer, should just go over and talk to whomever, and then, you know, you guys collaborate. To me, that just sounds fucking horrible. Like someone who's just like, yeah, we're gonna do this feature, and then they just kind of go do it without really talking with anybody, especially if you have 100 or 200 person studio or even bigger, like Destiny.
Gotta be so chaotic.
It just seems so disorganized. And you know, some people are like, ah, yes, this is the company's, you know, magic, or you know, BioWare magic, or the Naughty Dog magic, and that's how they can create these great games. But I'm just like, that just sounds fucking horrible to manage all this shit.
I could see that happening if it like working really well, if there was like along with all of that, like if their like structure was almost entirely horizontal and they also had a means of like consensus building really quickly on ideas and whether like they want to include things. So like if they had some sort of like in-house app for like an in-house GitLab with all of the ideas of how like different things that they want to include in the game, and you had like a period of time in which people could evaluate them and then like determine whether or not the company wants to do it or not. And we actually do see that in a much smaller scale with the Shovel Knight game, where it's five people who made Shovel Knight, and they met and discussed everything and trusted each other on like different like points of like what they should do. But at the end of the day, anyone could like say like, let's not do that, or I don't feel like that's going to work for the game, what have you. But with 100 or 200 people, you do really start to get into like organizational issues that, unless you have a really good solution, are just going to cause chaos for you rather than like, I don't know, deliver game magic.
Yeah, like, okay, I'm going to go on a slight tangent because, boy howdy, I do not like plot structure. About 6 years ago, Valve came out with their employee handbook. And so you read through it, and you can still even find it online. It's a PDF. Like, it's not just some leaked thing. It's like, they're like, oh, here's kind of probably a marketing way, or a way to, you know, recruit people to work at Valve. Their biggest thing was, like, we're a flat structure. You can collaborate with whomever you want to work on a project. Now, that sounds fucking awesome, right? You get to collaborate with people. You had an idea. You get people. You do the elevator pitch. You get people to work on it. The problem is that what happens after the game comes out and there's just the grunt shit work of killing bugs? What happens? No one wants to do that work. That is the kind of the unfun part of developing software sometimes, is you have to do the shitty work to make it keep working if you're going to patch. So this is why Half-Life 3 isn't a thing. They have tried multiple times and prototypes, and then they just kind of abandoned it. I mean, granted, it probably not is all due to the flat structure, but you have to kind of wonder, like, well, if they maybe had a more quote-unquote traditional, you know, they have a producer who does the scheduling, who like, you know, ask Gabe, hey, can we do Half-Life 3? And he's like, cool, go do Half-Life 3. And then, you know, show me what you get in 6 months or whatever the fuck milestone. And then, you know, actually go through, you know, a producer, here's the, you know, mark, you know, developers and yada, yada, yada. Could we have Half-Life 3? Most likely not, because Valve is very much interested in pushing new technology. Sure. That's their thing. That's also part of the reason. But
that's why they have Alex, it's like, right?
Yeah. I mean, yeah, the VR shit, because that's what they're finally trying to do now. You know, but I just, it's interesting how much more like how the flat structure kind of is in place in a lot of these places. I kind of expected from more of these studios to not. However, these guys probably been around since the 1990s. Who probably been in these, like if they've been software developers before, they probably had a bad, you know, like, fuck how we did shit in the, you know, 90s to try and develop stuff. We're going to just try this new way that's a bit more laissez-faire. And that's how they just decided to structure their studio. I mean, that could plainly
absolutely. I would also, I'd argue that we could have Half-Life 3, but we need to kill a really, really foundational to our society golden calf to do that. But then anyone can make Half-Life 3, anyone who is passionate enough about it. And that golden calf is intellectual property laws.
Fair. I mean, people have been making technically Half-Life remakes. You know, there's Black Mesa, there's other, what's that game? Fuck. Like, it's pretty much an expansion of the world that's in Half-Life. So, like, it's kind of there, but I don't know exactly what Valve's policy, I guess, is. I guess as long as you're not saying this is my Gordon
and,
Freeman.
And it is potentially possible for even Valve, because Valve is not 100% horizontal. Like, Gabe is still at the top. So
this is correct, yes.
It is possible for there to be a directive from Gabe saying, okay, we're launching this game, and I know nobody likes to crunch bugs and fix bugs, but we're going to need to, like, fix bugs for, like, 3 months. So everyone who, like, make bug bounties, or, like, and a sliding scale of a bug bounty, because something that's talked about in this game is, in this book, is that when you get a game in your hands that's been published and sent out, and you find bugs, they already know about that bug, because they determined that bug was not game-breaking enough to prevent the game from shipping. They were busy fixing bugs that broke the game. So he could do, like, a sliding scale of, like, okay, anyone who wants to, like, fix these level of bugs, or find these level of bugs, like, this is how much extra you would get on your paycheck, or, like, depending on number of bugs, like, you get to come, you win, and the other top five bug fixers get to come on my yacht and rub oil all over my body. but that there is, or even, like, make the make the code for the game once we killed IP. So like other people have developed Half-Life 3, but now Steam say has developed Valve has developed Half-Life 3 as well. And you've made your source code for your Half-Life 3 available on Valve GitHub page, and people can submit bug fixes. And then you can choose whether or not to include those in the version of Half-Life 3 that you're selling on Steam, the platform. Like, there are ways to get this done, but like not with the current structures that we have in place right now. What was surprising to me about the process for making games? Studio size. I had always assumed that like most games were developed by like relatively large studios, might have like 50 people to a couple hundred people. Stardew Valley, one guy. Shovel Knight, five people. Like a lot of these games, for a lot of their development, because of the way that development companies work, there might be 20, 30 people for half of the development of the game, which is kind of crazy to me. Like, I don't know. It's just like, it really jumped out at like how massive or like how polished some of these things can be and like what people are capable of if they really like set their mind to it, to creating. And I mean, it should be obvious from like art from ages and millennia past that people are able to dedicate themselves to things they're passionate about and create like absolute masterpieces. But it still is really impressive sometimes.
Yeah, for sure. I'm not surprised with studio size. Especially with 3D games, like it's such a step up mm-hmm. from 2D games, like a lot. Like I tried making a 3D game and it just trying, and I use like preset models that I got from it, you know, for free, and just trying to get a walking animation took me like almost a week before mm-hmm. I abandoned the mm-hmm. fucking project. So it's not surprising to me that these 2D games are made by mm-hmm. way mm-hmm. less people. And 3D games just adds more complexity. Cause like, if you ever look at it, okay, sure. For instance, Witcher 3, you see so much hair or clothes just tearing into each mm-hmm. other and shit like that. Like you can't, it is such a fuck, like you see shit from like, I bet you in Cyberpunk 2077, they will still that fucking problem.
Looking at some of the memes from like a week or two ago, like they're having face rendering problem.
Yeah, like there's texture popping, and like that's kind of one of the problems of these massive 3D types of games is that you're just gonna get weird interactions that you cannot always mm-hmm. fix. Like they're gonna look mm-hmm. slightly imperfect. It's difficult, right? Because you want to, you know, give the, you know, consumers a really good and solid experience, but you also can't account for every weird sliding face thing that's gonna fucking happen during one scene at one point in time, because the character when they interact, we're like 5 centimeters over. So everything looks all fucked up, mm-hmm. like, you know, so, and you see, and it's funny because if you really pay attention, you're like, why do they always like have me stop there and then make me walk a certain way or like take the controls away from me? It's like, that's because they were trying to avoid a game crashing mm-hmm. bug or some shit to like kind of cover up mm-hmm. a problem. Just a bunch of fun stuff like that.
That just gets back to like that final question that we've been dancing around, but we'll get there. Let's discuss E3. Is it dead?
I think because of COVID, it's been, oh man. So E3 is, if you don't know, it's an electronic it's like Electronic Entertainment Expo, so E3. But generally, it's a gaming exposition, and a lot of journalists are usually used to be only journalists and insider or game industry folks were invited. Then they open it up to the public because money and money. So
I know money.
It's held in LA, and yeah, I know, right? I hardly knew her. So it's in LA. It's during June. Every game developer, would-be game developer, will go there, get a demo created, and they'll show it off. Now it's a lot of these big theaters, big production type things. It now lasts for a fucking week. It used to be like a weekend. It's a whole big deal. And then they started fucking up. So first, I think 2 years ago, they leaked a bunch of journalist information, like their address, their emails and shit. Yeah. Yeah, so they leaked it, and then they kind of like, oh, they didn't say anything until someone was like, holy shit, this is from this company who runs it. And then they were like, oopsie whoopsie, don't sue us. And then they made everyone sign a contract that says, please don't sue us, essentially. So a lot of people were pissed at them. And then once COVID happened, they were trying to be like, okay, we're gonna still do it, you guys. We're just gonna take precautions. And then LA, the city was like, no, you guys are fucking Jesus. Not having an expo. And so, and they're also like in the red. So like a bunch. So anyway, E3 is most likely dead at this point. There's this no way. There's been a lot of like Sony, for example, actually Nintendo, they have like their own little update thing. And they've been doing that. I think they haven't even went to the last E3. They just had like their own little treehouse or whatever the fuck it's called. They just show videos of their upcoming projects and then say, yep, okay, we're done. And like they're 30 minutes instead of flying everyone out, doing all this shit. And then, you know, that. So it's mentioned several times, like I'm pretty sure in every single fucking chapter, except for Stardew Valley, that everyone's trying to crunch for E3. And show off a product that most likely will not happen or will not be in the game.
A couple times they're like, so, we are trying to like make something that is going to be in the game, or like at least the art assets and the combat will be in the game, what have you. Try and salvage as much as they can. Yeah.
Generally, that does not happen. That happened with Witcher 3. Like people were like, whoa, we got downgraded in graphics. And CD Projekt Red's like, no, you guys didn't. Like, it's totally the same. And it's, if you do ever comparison screenshots, it's totally fucking different. Like, it totally is. I think they mentioned that. But like, in the all of his sub, not postscripts, whatever. All of his stars that he put in.
Yeah.
If you like read through the end of it, he mentions it. So you have all these people trying to crunch for E3, and I guess since E3 is dying, will that now be the case? Will developers now or these companies now try to crunch for that type of stuff to show a demo? Will they just do here's a trailer, just do trailers that they usually do, which are also lies, but whatever. But that's probably a bit easier. You can just release the trailer and do it how you want and
so,
be good. Like, I don't know.
Part of my concern is E3 was a place for a lot of like AAA developers and production companies to show like their big best like new thing that was coming out. But it was also, and just to keep in mind for everyone listening, I've never been to E3. I don't like, I'm speaking out of my ass here, but based on what this book was telling me, like, small studios that nobody had heard about were able to book time and booths at this. And like, sure, there will be other conventions where like you can go like see games that are being developed at a con that's near us, MAGFest. They have games that are being developed and being worked on, and people have hacked together. But you don't get journalists generally who are there specifically to cover those games and talk about those games. So I really think that it is going to be detrimental to smaller studios and like indie developers to not have something like E3. Will something else pop up in its place? Maybe for small games, but then like how I don't know how much like E3 was tied in with the big developers, like how much of that was like them funding E3 to exist or what have you. I don't know.
Yeah, I'm not sure about who funds who. I'm assuming they probably asked for like donations or something like that. I'm pretty sure it's like most conventions, usually like a nonprofit or, you know, 503c type of shit. So they might have been like, hey, you know, you want to fork some money over to, you know, do the presentation. We're probably, okay, after this, we still need, you know, money for staffing or marketing or whatever.
Yeah, I don't know. Maybe they'll declare bankruptcy and then like pop up like a phoenix after a few years. But it certainly could be the end of E3 because like, even for small developers, like you can go and if your game looks really nice, you can go and post that on Reddit or Twitch.
Yeah, you can. When this book came out, this was 2016, and this was probably just on the cusp of gaming influencers. It was funny. I watched a Twitch ad on Twitch. And they had the, instead of like game streamer or streamer, it was streamer influencer. And I thought that was interesting that they've changed that. But now I think maybe it was mentioned, but like getting a well-known YouTuber or streamer to do your, like to stream your game is like a really huge impact. For instance, Among Us, like it's the latest like fad game that blew up, even though the game came out four years ago. So...
Wow.
Yeah.
Huh.
Yep. Yeah. So, you know, it's just like that could happen, but it's like going to E3 is a more better bet. You get the eyeballs on there. Like you're more likely to get eyeballs on there than some random streamer picking your game out of a random list of Steam games and streaming it and it, you know, takes off. So, there are other gaming conventions like PAX. Blizzard even has gone there and done like revealing of Overwatch and like Diablo 3 and stuff like that.
Hilarious, because they have their own convention.
Yes. And but that convention is more exclusive. That's more of a, it's like, it's obviously their convention, but it's also for their, you know, for the fans or whatever.
For the fans' wallet.
I've been to enough BlizzCons. Yes, that's for sure. Because boy, howdy, they super lean, like over the years, they super leaned on, oh, we have a trading post. Oh, we have pins. Oh, we have, you know, actually, yeah, just more pins and other collectible type shit. Because they've already had those people kind of locked in because of WoW. It was easy to transition from, oh, you can get exclusive mounts and WoW to, oh, let's, you can get exclusive real tangible things, you know?
This isn't in our questions, but which game's story was the most interesting?
I thought the most interesting one was the Dragon Age Inquisition. I really liked BioWare games. I really enjoyed Dragon Age Origins up to a point, and it's always before you go into the tunnels, and then I fucking quit the game. Finally played Dragon Age 2. And I was really bummed that people did not like that game. Like, that's their reasoning for the way that they made Dragon Inquisition was because of how people reacted to Dragon Age 2. And Dragon Age 2 is panned because it reuses a lot of set pieces, which is totally fucking true. It's very bare bones in terms, not bare bones in combat, but they really stripped down the combat. And it was made in a year and a half. So that sucks ass. They, because pretty much EA was like, ooh, you know, they started like, oh, dollar signs here. All right, we need to do a fast follow. And they're just like, wait, what? Like, yep, give us a Dragon Age 2 and fall, whatever the fuck.
With Origins, didn't it take like 7 years?
Yeah, it took, like 5 to 7 years to make. So, you know, even if you do have the same engine and you're using the same engine, It's not, you shouldn't make a game in a year and a half. Anyway, I thought Inquisition was good because it really, that's like kind of the start of the downfall of BioWare in general. And especially with their use of the Frostbite engine. And it's described in the book, it's used for, you know, Battlefield games. And Battlefield games are first-person shooters. And there's some vehicle movement, and that's about it. And just the fact that they had to fucking essentially make their own add-ons for this engine.
Re-import them when the engine was updated.
Yeah, and then do that. And I'm just like, see, this is, to me, this is part of the reason why game development is so fucking weird compared to software development. So with software development, you try to just automate a bunch of dumb shit that you want to do. And it seems like with game development, you have to do so much shit manually. That's where you, everything starts just slowing down. Like, you may think, oh, no big deal. It takes me 15 minutes to re-add this shit. But then you think about how often they probably push a build. They probably have like a nightly fucking build for this game engine. And you have to keep doing it every single fucking day. And then be like, okay, well, does my import, does everything work correctly from last night's build
and
to today's build?
And as you add more tools and as you add more assets, it's just more to check and more to re-add. It's,
Yeah, and it's like, so Dragon Age Inquisition comes out. It comes out just before Witcher 3. Unfortunately, people made the comparison between them. I think that's really fucking unfair because they both serve kind of, yeah, they're both, you know, action RPG games, but they both serve kind of, I would say, different purposes. Dragon Age Inquisition is about, you know, you as this Inquisitor, and you go do stuff with the Blight. I played the game, and then I kind of got bored. It's fun. Witcher 3 is following Geralt's story and kind of wrapping up the Witcher CD Projekt Red's fan fiction of The Witcher. Yeah, I said it. It's a fan fiction. Anyway, so I just thought it was interesting how they had to overcome a, learn a new engine, add to an engine that does not, is not for RPGs, and managed to not like release the game without like a massive day one patch or, you know, like the Diablo 3's Era 104 for like 2 or 3 days. Cause I remember staying up for Diablo 3 and then just going back to bed when I couldn't log in. Like, if, like that's pretty fucking remarkable. However, like that was cool. However, if you look at Mass Effect Andromeda, which is a different issue because they gave it to a studio that has not worked with Frostbite, so they had to relearn everyone's fucking mistakes. And Anthem, which is a game that literally you don't, I don't, no one knows what you do in Anthem. Like, so yeah. It's like the, it's really interesting how Dragon Age Inquisition came out pretty okay. They had some really good DLC, which I've heard. I was going to try to beat the fucking game because of the DLC. It sounded really interesting. And they, I'm pretty sure that just crushed them as a company. It just seems like after that game came out, they just got just crushed. Like, I bet, you know, it seems like if you notice throughout this book, there's a lot of former employers of these game companies. Yeah, that's also another fucking problem in general, is that there's a lot of veterans that will leave the game. I'm going on these tangents, but whatever. There's a lot of these veteran game developers and, you know, other leads that will leave because they're just like, holy fuck, I'm burnt out. Unlike software, some software development companies, I've had people who stay there for 10 or 15 years, even though, you know, places in California, you kind of hop around quite a bit. Like, generally, if you get taken care of pretty well, you'll stay at a fucking company. And that doesn't seem to be the case with a lot of these places.
Definitely agree with that sentiment. I feel like that also ties into our last question.
Correct.
I would say there were, I enjoyed reading all of these, but the two that really stood out to me were Stardew Valley and the Destiny story. And I didn't really, I'm not a first person shooter player. So I never really did Halo. And I didn't do Destiny, but reading about the absolute shit fest that Destiny was on launch, and the just the memes of like, okay, let's have what's his name? What is his name? The guy who does the speaking, who does all the speaking in Destiny.
Oh my gosh, I just I picture his face, but
doing some skimming, please. Peter Dinklage, yeah. Just realizing that like they development, surprise that it interested and like unact it's you're trying.
All right, Craig is back. So if you ever watch any TV shows with like guests and voice actors, some of them are just not good and they're very wooden. Like they've never actually done voice acting before. And it's pretty different from actual acting if you ever just listen to voice actors like interviews. So I don't think Peter Dinklage has ever done any voice acting. So being like, okay, so now I need you to do a fantasy sci-fi thing and have the script all change all on you. Like, of course you're never gonna get a good fucking performance out of him. But also, once again,
a pocket-sized robot, by the way.
Yes. Once again, hiring someone who's famous is never a good fucking idea. You pretty much burned $1 million on fire.
Yeah. Like, like you could get like Mark Hamill. Mark Hamill is famous, but he's also a voice actor. Like, has been doing it for decades. There's a stable of American voice actors, and there's a stable of I'm sure voice actors in any country. But there's a stable of voice actors, and you give them feed, and you brush down their coats, and sometimes you take them out for a ride, and then have them record audio for your video game. That was clearly a joke on the fact that I decided to use the word stable instead of like, there is a small like cadre of voice actors that are pros. And they'll show up in all sorts of things. You're, I'm sure, very familiar with this because you've consumed things with voice actors from both like American media as well as Japanese media. And we've discussed this in the manga episode anyway. But like, yeah, general, like there's a game that came out a couple of years ago that had Kevin Spacey doing the voice acting, and it was
Call of Duty.
And from what I understand, not good.
I'm not surprised, because once again, they get these famous actors and they just don't know how to do voice acting, or these directors just don't know how to lead these actors. I don't know, really. I mean, there's like several, like Nolan North and I forgot all fucking ready, Ashley something or another. Anyway, there's just a bunch that are there that know how to do it properly, and it's just like, please stop spending all this fucking money on actors or actresses to do these voice acting, because it just sounds really bad. Like, most of the time you can tell they're reading from a script and they're just like, what the fuck is this all about?
And that probably I'm just gonna go for it and transition into our last question, which was, how would all of game dev be better under socialism, communism, not capitalism? Any flavor of those three that you can envision? So many of these problems just would not be, like, you wouldn't be burning $1 million on Peter Dinklage or Kevin Spacey, or Captain Hammer, his name is, I can't remember, because like, you wouldn't have like the necessary incentive of like, oh, this game has Peter Dinklage in it. Like, it's going to be amazing. Like, make art, just don't be homeless, have the tools you need, make art.
I think also deadlines wouldn't be so fucking important. Most people, it's actually really interesting. because I want to bring this up, and I was going to make this as an interesting thing. So with Stardew Valley, he worked on this by himself, and he updated the blog and everything else. And then he kind of said, hey guys, I'm sorry, I'm working by myself, and I need to delay this game. And to be quite honest, I was surprised he didn't get death threats. Like, I was expecting him to get death threats or other shit. And even CD Projekt Red were like, hey, we're sorry, we need to delay the game.
For most people, 2077?
Yeah, 2077, we need to delay the game. They also delayed Witcher 3 too. So the thing is, most people are fucking patient about the game. The consumer, the customers trying to buy the game are not really the problem. They're not the ones who are doing the pressure. It's the board members. It's these stakeholders who are like, well, we need to get this out by this quarter. Because
we are depending on this for returns. Or we have made promises to people who have loaned us money that we would have like X amount of like returns or X amount of profit. Or our shareholders are interested in seeing.
Yeah, so another example of a rushed game because it needed to they had nothing else to come out for the quarter is Warcraft 3 Reforged. That game was not prepared. It was not ready to come out, and it is still buggy, piece of shit mess. And they're kind of working on it, maybe, but like it seems very obvious that they've taken people off that project and probably they've gone elsewhere, like in the company or whatever. And the reason why it came out the way it did is because at the time, this was just after BlizzCon. It was a very shitty BlizzCon.
For context for everyone, BlizzCon is in November?
Yes, it's November. Okay. So they came out. So BlizzCon, they usually do like their big announcements there and their big reveals there. So they said, hey, we're having Overwatch 2. We're going to have, you know, the World of Warcraft expansion, Shadowlands, which is actually, it just came out literally 2 days ago, 3 days ago, last week. Yeah, it seems pretty fun. I'm not going to go back to fucking World of Warcraft, but it's
already destroyed my left hand. I don't need anything more.
So the thing was that they had nothing else coming out for the end of 2019. They've already said, hey, we're fucking, technically we're done with StarCraft 2. And boy, howdy, they announced that literally 3 months ago. And people are actually happy because Blizzard just kind of has fumbled that football
for fucking
almost 10 years now. And they kind of just want them to stop being there. But anyway, the whole point is that Warcraft 3 Reforged came out. It was buggy. They had none of the features that they said. All the colors were all fucked up. You cannot even play the old Warcraft 3. You can't even go download it anywhere. You have to probably go to fucking torrent it. So
it was a huge... I shouldn't have thrown out my Warcraft 3 discs like a month ago.
Yeah. Yeah, you should have at least ISO'd those motherfuckers and put them somewhere. Anyway, actually, I can probably just give you the my ISO. Anyway.
By the way, this BlizzCon, isn't it also the one where they were like, we're giving you a mobile game for Diablo 3.
So that was the year before. So what they did for this year, they had to come out with a bunch of fucking games. They had to be like, okay, we're doing Diablo 4, you can play it right here. We have Overwatch 2, you can play that here. We have Shadowlands, you can play that here. And you're like, wow, that's really great. And like, yeah, all those things are coming out later. So there's nothing for you to look forward to to buy from Blizzard. Yes. And thus Warcraft 3 Reforged is like, you're now going to be pushed up and everyone's like, and a lot of these pro gamers and other people who are really into fucking Warcraft 3 Reforged were like, well, that's really weird because y'all said these features are gonna be here, but it doesn't like the betas that we've been participating in. You haven't added them, but you're releasing in 2 weeks? Like, what the fuck is all that about? And then, you know, there was hope, and then it got crushed immediately.
So
the whole point is that if we're not trying to ship games based on quarterly returns or your revenue for that fucking quarter, then there'll be less of this this is a feature in which you get these buggy-ass games. Or subpar games. You can be like, well, they'll patch them. It's okay. They should be able, maybe it's okay. Maybe we should be releasing maybe they should be releasing these subpar games. The problem is that once again, their big headline news when it says Warcraft 3 Reforged is under fucking cooked. So then your game gets panned on Metacritic. I think it got down to like 1.2 or some shit. And it kept actually started at like 2 and it kept getting lowered. The Warcraft 3 subreddit was in fucking revolt. Mm-hmm. It was such like a disaster that I don't think it has recovered. Like the thing is like, I don't know if it has recovered. I'm making an assumption based on how my day of looking at the release and being like, well, I'm out of here. I'm not gonna go look at this fucking game again. It is fucking donezo. Mm-hmm. Like, so
and
yeah, as you can tell, I'm very mad about this because I was looking forward to it and then it just turned out to be garbage.
I didn't even know it was happening. Yeah, but it so that would be fantastic because then you wouldn't have these games that are coming out before they absolutely should. And then you also wouldn't have the threat of like, well, if you don't put out this game by this time, you're just out of money. I hope you like eating air and sleeping on the street. We still contractually like need this game done. So either you're putting out shit or you're homeless. Goodbye.
Yeah. I also think like the Halo Wars RTS game, I think if Microsoft allowed them to make whatever they wanted,
it would probably be a good game.
Yeah, I didn't know Halo Wars even had Halo Wars 2. I didn't know Halo Wars even fucking came out. I remember there was a demo and the E3 showing, and I was like, that's neat, but I'm going to play something on the computer. But I didn't realize it got released, and then I didn't realize that studio fucking got closed down, which is like, just reading that, like, so, you know, some people saved their jobs, and people had to figure out who got their jobs saved. Yeah. And it's like, oh my, that's a shitty situation to be in. Like, holy fuck.
Like, it's one like, thing to, like, okay, let's do, like, sports team tryout. And then, like, you post, like, who got on and who didn't up on, like, some bulletin board and everyone can go look at their own time. It is totally different to be like, okay, who's going to have a job in 4 months and who isn't? Also, keep working.
Yeah. And then, you know, it's just it also seems like studios, Granny Hewley did one of them that had that problem, but there's another one who made the Dead Rising games from Capcom where they get pigeonholed into doing these one type of games and that is it. And people don't like doing the same shit over and over and over again. They don't like creating the same thing over and over again. So it's like you kind of need a allowing if we didn't have these publishers and these fucking that had to be beholden to their stockholders and, you know, their board members and be like, oh, yeah, we're going to come out this like crazy, you know, we're going to come out with kind of a risky experimental game. Then we might have like games that aren't so clony because like when Gears of War came out, there was literally a bunch of Gears of War, like a lot of games used to, you know, the cover shooter. That was like a really big fucking deal. Like the pre-Doom, before Doom 2016 came out, was going to be another cover shooter type of game before, like they showed it as a preview at QuakeCon and people did not react great and like, okay, we're scrapping this and just starting all over again. Granted, id Software can do that because id Software is known, like has enough to really do that. And also, I guess ZeniMax is like, yeah, do whatever. We'll make our own weird mobile games. And Bethesda's just like, yeah, keep you guys do you. And we'll keep making Skyrim for every single fucking console in the world.
So much of this would be answered by like, weird games would not be a risk if there wasn't the you live or die by whether it sells well. Like if your needs were met, if housing, healthcare, food, water, access to the internet, reasonable transportation, education, what have you, the basics were met and you could just like get together with people in your city in like game maker spaces. And like, you could work on a game by yourself, you could work with other people, you could take whatever quote risk you want, because the risk is only there if there's a threat of like, if this doesn't sell well, you're done.
Right.
And
sorry, go on.
If that's not there, make whatever weird shit you want.
Exactly. However, there's not really a however, but there are, I guess it's a positive thing. There are, I found two examples of game studios that are co-ops. Mm-hmm. One is Motion Twin. They came out with Dead Cells. They've been around since 2001. So it's not like, oh, this is just a, you know, a studio that came out after like, you know, 5 years. They had like a really big hit. Granted, Motion Twin is in France.
Still under
so
capitalism.
They have a, true, but they're culturally would is slightly,
slightly,
you know,
better to workers, unless you want to film the police.
Yes. Another game studio, this is out of the ashes of the Skullgirls debacle, because their CEO is a huge dipshit and everyone quit. So they made their own co-op studio, and there is another game studio by the like the group that made A Night in the Woods. They have a, you know, a co-op studio. They haven't released a game yet, but like that's what they're working on. So granted, this is still under capitalism, but there, I'm curious to see what other games come from these co-op studios. And like, I hope there's no some expose later. It's like, oh yeah, no, we still have crunch. We still have to do all that. Like, you know, they're not really a co-op, but they say they are, you know, shit like that. Like, I hope that's not the fucking case, you know.
Is Supergiant a co-op?
I don't think so.
Okay. I'm looking it up real quick.
Okay.
I really need to practice with this keyboard some more. To our listeners, I do not recommend changing your key layout and then not practicing with it, because it makes you type like a grandma. I don't know that I'm finding the right Supergiant.
Oh, nice.
Supergiant provides enterprise Kubernetes support subscriptions. no, yeah, okay. So I'll, anyway. But yeah, I'm sure there are other like smaller co-ops, and really technically any like individual developer who's making a game, I guess, is a co-op, because I mean, yeah, what have you. But yeah, it. I still wonder, like, where are these games getting their, or developers getting their funding? Are they doing like Indiegogos, or what is the one that is actually talked about in the book? I'm blanking.
Oh, Kickstarter.
Yeah, are they doing Kickstarters, or do they have a publisher, or and like, is the publisher a co-op, or is it just a normal publisher and then the development company is a co-op? I don't know. It's definitely a good move and something in the right direction, but I it's not their fault, but I'm still saddened every day that we still have capitalism. Anyway,
is there anything else you want to discuss with this book? Any closing thoughts?
If he was still alive, how do you feel Karl Marx would respond to this book? No, that's a joke question. You don't have to. No. This was a really interesting book. It definitely, it's written really well. It's very, engaging, and light for, anyone who's interested in reading it. And I liked it.
Nice. Yeah, I think it was also a good book, especially for if you're not even really into video games, or even if you are, it's just good. So what's pretty cool now, if you're into like, oh, I kind of want to make a video game, I want to see how hard it is, there's a lot of free tools out there and assets you can use to make your own game. It's pretty fun and it's frustrating, like most programming projects and any other art project. So, you know, there's Unity, there's Godot, there's a bunch of Python, like Pi visual novel stuff, Pyren, I think. So, you know, go check those out. All right. So for December, we're going to dive into a meaty book called Caliban and the Witch.
I'm excited to pick this up on December 10th and be like, okay, how bad do I have to crunch? Oh, you know, just 4 hours a day for every day for the rest of the month? Cool.
My goodness.
I'm joking. I don't know. Let's find out. Let's look it up.
Well,
for the listener.
And then for January 2021, the new year, new book is going to be The Cathedral and the Bazaar, which also might be a meaty book. We'll see.
It's not that thick. It's like maybe 250 pages.
Oh, okay. Well, it's not that bad. It's going to have some Linux stuff in it. So I guess if you want to, Unix, whatever the fuck. I don't give a fuck that noise. That fight's stupid and I don't understand it. So I hate it. So how meaty
is
and
Caliban's
how
much... only 288 pages.
Okay.
It
so
is going to be,
you might be
a
able...
question of like, is it Origi's long 20th century 288 pages or
God,
is it,
yeah.
Blood, Sweat, and Pixels 288 pages. I have a feeling it's probably going to be
probably in between.
It's certainly going to be in between, but I have a feeling it's going to lean towards the more academic side of things. It does, other books about witches do come up. Actually, she's written three books about witches and women. So those may go on the book list for later. But we'll see how this goes. It probably won't be as bad as it, you know, I'm just going to say, it's definitely not going to be as hard as Origi.
Yes.
As useful to know. Ooh, I actually, for the listeners and for you, Angela, I actually got into a discussion about capitalism in the Shroom subreddit and used some of what I learned from Origi in that. End of statement.
Did you win? Okay, good. That's all that matters, right? Is winning in a debate.
Yeah. It wasn't so much of a debate. It was like somebody was like, blah, blah, Tencent bad, communism bad. And I'm like, well, they're not even one of the largest like owners of Reddit. So like, okay. Also, communism is rad as fuck. And they're like, you seem like blah, 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 blah. And I'm like, okay, well, cool. Communism still rad as fuck. And they're like, you know, socialism seems fine as like democratic capitalism, but blah, 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 blah. More things that are incredibly wrong and just show like no evidence of actually understanding any of the terms that I'm throwing out. And I mean this with no disrespect. You have no idea what you're talking about. And then explain things. It was fun. It's been a while since I've gotten into a quote unquote argument or discussion on Reddit, because normally it is not worth my time. Anyway.
So remember, don't argue on Reddit. And
books are
good.
Actually.
Actually.
Wow, that was on time.